Welcome back to Freedom Papers. Connor, thanks for joining.
Hey, great to be here again.
You guys, today's a momentous day because I'm a little emotional about it actually now as I'm saying this, but we have done all of the first section, part one of two parts of The Federalist. We finished 36 last episode. 37 is the first paper, a part of section two of The Federalist. And section two is going through the Constitution, the structure of the actual proposed Constitution at the time. We're no longer talking about the general arguments made in favor of why we should become a union, a stronger union to begin with. That was the first section. Connor, we're moving on.
48 more papers left.
I can't believe we're already at 37. I feel like an old woman. This has been a blast. Thanks for sitting here.
Yeah.
We've sat here a lot.
It's true. It's true.
A lot. Sometimes you abandon me.
I'm sorry.
And it's lonesome on this stage. Being a superstar is hard up on stage. I've got a five-piece band standing behind me, looking at the backside of me, as Waylon says.
And they're asking if Hank done it this way.
Listen, I just went to Nashville, and let me just tell you, are you sure Hank done it this way? Makes a lot more sense to me now.
It does.
I heard more hip hop. My mom and I, let's just start with a story in honor of this starting of section two. My mom and I go to Nashville and we're there because my dad is a fraud conference. It's a whole thing. And so my mom's never been. And so she is a classic country dancer. Mm-hmm. My parents couple dance. It's really cute.
It's really cute.
We're walking down the main Broadway hill at the top of Broadway. Mm-hmm. And my mom's like, it's the Ryman. And we're going like this. And we're going to Nashville. She's got her boots on. And this like hip-hop guy, clear hip-hop guy on a motorcycle drives by us blasting from a boombox or whatever this hip-hop rap song. And then we get to the first bar. And from the rooftop bar, they're blasting a hip-hop song. And so just imagine the scene of Broadway. And my mom's genuinely confused of like, what am I hearing right now? And
it is confusing.
That song of did Hank really do it this way? He did not. I can answer that now.
We have seen America be invaded culturally by those who do not wish to retain the roots of the nation that was built. We see people who have built nothing destroy that which was built before them. And they don't really have the right to do that. And why we continue to let them do that is beyond me. But similar story. I was in Fort Worth.
Don't tell me.
Stockyards, walking down the stockyards. And I was showing my girlfriend, she'd never been to the stockyards. I'm from Texas, obviously.
Oh.
And I'm telling her, it's just cowboys everywhere. And it's like real Texas. And it just feels like, you know, they actually run cattle through here and everything. And there's rodeos and stuff. And we get out of the car and we're just blasted by this like boombox bass, you know, rap music. And I'm like, what the hell happened to the Texas that I knew?
Does Fort Worth ever cross your mind?
It does. And it's not as savory as it used to be.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was looking at downtown Fort Worth and I find it so interesting, whether it's Montana or the genuine places that we can live at our desired lifestyles that we're used to. Those places have been taken over, purchased, and sold out to people that are in a higher wealth status, I would say, that can afford to create this little Yellowstone vibe, but not actually live the Yellowstone vibe.
Right.
Same thing's happening with Texas. And so I had said, I'm looking for like a downtown apartment over one of the shops or something like that. I remember I was looking and someone said, that's not a thing anymore in Fort Worth. Probably 5 or 7 years ago, they were all bought by hipsters and turned into lofts that nobody could ever possibly afford anymore. And just hearing that, it's really sad because if you think of it in the sense that a lot of people say, the country people can then just sell their houses and then move further out to the countryside. It's like, why do we have to do that though?
Yeah.
Why do people have to sell their homes because they can no longer afford the property taxes because liberals move here and then increase the value of our house? Yes, it's very nice. I get the argument that we'll benefit from being able to sell our home that we can't afford anymore and we'll make a profit and then we'll go buy out in the countryside.
In the first place.
Maybe we want to stay there where our families were. And that's the thing. We can't then just say, we'll just go out further and further, because then you're hours from a hospital. You are incredibly far from regular society. You used to not have to do that to live an affordable country lifestyle and get a home and land.
Yeah. It's almost like it's intentional. And it's not just something that the left is doing. The right does it as well.
Yeah.
I mean, they invite these people into their states. We call them ribbon cutting. I don't know if I can say this on the show, but
say it.
They're ribbon cutting. Like, yeah, come on in, mega corporation.
Yeah.
And bring all your people from Connecticut and California and New York, and we'll welcome you here because it's about the GDP, right? And they neglect culture, and then culture dies.
Do you want to know? I had an epitome.
Okay.
Epiphany?
Epiphany.
We're dumb today. I had an epiphany. Morgan, as a little wannabe homemaker, homeschool mom, I always told myself if I do the podcast stuff and do my communication work, and then I buy rental properties, I will be able to be at home with my babies and have income coming in for my family. Because I don't know who I'm going to marry.
Passive
I don't know
income, right?
what their income's going to look like. Right. I don't ever want, oh, well, we can't afford you to be able to homeschool, you to be able to stay home, all that stuff. I never want that to happen. And affordability is an issue these days.
Totally.
And so it's not as easy as it is to have a one-income home. So either way, I always saw that. And the more that I read, the more that I just get into these issues of declining rural America, I feel bad about telling myself, oh, I'm going to become an Airbnb host. I'm going to get little properties and Airbnb them out. I'm going to rent out this house. I rent out a house in Texas right now. And I'm kind of sad about it because I'm like, what am I doing? In a way, I'm encouraging someone to be able to be in a home instead of an apartment. I do think that's healthy in terms of being able to have a little home. But I'm also taking away the opportunity and I'm helping increase, not helping, I'm increasing the cost of the homes in those communities. And I was like, I am like a communist right now that hates landowners. It was a whole mess. I went through a mess. Okay.
I don't think that you're doing the wrong thing.
Thank you. I need Connor's validation.
Like, no, I mean you're doing the right thing in a system that is overshadowing your good deed with malicious intent, right? So you're not BlackRock. You're not the one who's actually going out there and doing
a
major impact. They're the bad guys here.
Yeah.
And you're just kind of a consequence of that system. And so,
but I did read something about how a lot of really rich city people, they just go to the countryside and they buy up when I, like they have the money to just be like, I want that one. And they just keep buying up little cabins and homes and stuff. And then they Airbnb it out. And then what do you know? All these homes that used to be homes where people could go buy and live there and that would be their only property, they're all being taken up by people that want to create little winery Airbnbs for the weekend.
It creates a transient community and there's no
it's
real
sad.
Grounding and roots there. Another really good book. We just did a book recommendation in the last episode. And then there's another good one that I'll recommend on this episode. It's called Bowling Alone. There's another one that I'm going to tell you about because it's really important, actually. So give me one second, Anthony.
I'm a little radical. I mean, and sorry, you guys. This all is important to where America is going. I promise you. We wouldn't talk about these things unless they were super duper important, and
that's
they are.
That's true.
You won't hear it anywhere else, right, Connor?
You won't. Actually, I've recommended this one before on the show. It's called The Quest for Community by Robert Nisbet. And it talks about how the downfall of the American community and the church and everything that kind of surrounds this old idea of ownership and being grounded in something that's more permanent than yourself has been diminished by outside forces and the rise of secularism. And we need to figure out a way to get back to it. I was just watching Roadhouse. You ever seen Roadhouse with Patrick Swayze?
No.
It's a really good movie. It's actually kind of a crappy movie, but it's from the 80s. But it's about this really rich guy who basically owns an entire town. And then he just terrorizes everyone that's there who, you know, dares to go against his will or whatever, right? So if the local car dealership that's been there forever decides that they don't want to, you know, go with his plans for the city or for the town, he sends in a monster truck to basically just roll through their entire thing and like run over all of it. Anyway, but that's oddly enough on my mind, but it's a good movie, good book. And we have to stop letting oligarchs and rich liberals and corporations buy out middle America.
Well, honestly, speaking of Patrick Swayze, we were filming this June 27th, is it? And so Roe v. Wade just got overturned.
It did.
And my favorite movie growing up was Dirty Dancing.
Okay. I was like, I'm fascinated to see how you're going to tie this all together.
Yeah. No, my favorite movie growing up was Dirty Dancing. And I was talking to a screenwriter and we were talking about the hidden messages put into scripts. And it's not like, ooh, communism, good. Yeah. It's just more of little cultural things that they're starting to normalize, and have been for decades.
It's the long march through the institutions, right?
One of them in Dirty Dancing is the scary abortion. She doesn't have access to a safe abortion. She gets an abortion from some random person and gets seriously injured and hurt, and that's a big scene in the movie. And I was like, oh!
I tweeted that this weekend, and I'm probably going to get canceled for it. But it's like, you're going to go stick a hanger up your hoo-ha in the intent to go murder an innocent child, I don't feel bad for you. Just don't do that, right?
Anyway. Sometimes I'm a grandma, and I'm like, maybe just don't have sex with someone that you don't want to make
too.
The parent of your child. But then this is the thing. I say something like that, and then conservatives say, Morgan, you should be saying that they shouldn't have sex until marriage. And I try and tell these older conservatives, listen, you don't know what it's like out there. People will literally just go out to a bar, not even care about germs. They just start touching strangers and then bring that stranger back into their little apartment, into their bed. The germs. That person probably went to the bathroom on a public toilet. Connor. And then you're just inviting this random stranger into your bed, and then they could become the father of your child, but they don't even consider this to be a problem because it's like, well, I'm on the pill that completely disrupts my cycle. Yeah. And hey, I could get an abortion if this random stranger impregnates
me. Not anymore.
I don't know. So if anybody has a hard time with me saying just more... Connor, if anyone has a hard time with me talking about it from a non-Christian perspective, we have to start reaching the people in some way, okay? Oh, and so I'm just trying. Then we'll start working on the other things. But we just have to start saying some basics. Maybe don't have sex with the person if you wouldn't be thrilled to have them be the father of your child.
Bingo.
And
also
with
just
that,
natural family planning, like know when you're ovulating or not. Anyway.
Okay, yeah. I mean, the natural planning, well, that's the thing. Big Pharma tells you that you can't.
Right.
And in reality, you can only get pregnant like 4 days of the month.
Right.
I don't know. The other aspect of it, I'm taking out the Christian thing, taking out the conservative thing, the biological aspect that women become depressed when the guy doesn't like them the next day because we release deep connection hormones that guys don't when they have sex. The other aspect is, honestly, I see all of the problems in our country, it goes back to sex. It goes back to broken families. It goes back to fatherless children. It goes back to all of these core things that lead or that are coming from hookup culture and a derailment of these basic concepts. So for me, I'm like, I don't even want to touch a guy because I just care that much about the stability of the future family that I will have. I care too much
posterity.
At this point to put it at risk. I don't want to. Did you know if you have a kid? We'll end soon, I promise. Did you know if you have a kid out of wedlock or if you're married and then you divorce, whatever, and you're not with the mom anymore, the dad, and you try and date again, you have a 65% chance of going through another divorce or serious breakup because
totally
it's that
it.
Hard
totally
with it. The instability created from that original breakup to try and do it again with a child from another person. That kind of stuff is enough to scare me out of ever wanting to participate in any of that stuff. I put my foot down, and with that being said, do you think
legs.
Maybe we should...
But speaking about
Connor
stability,
crosses his legs.
I don't. I'm a man spreader. But speaking about stability, something that Madison
that
touches
was,
on.
That was a discussion that Madison would be so proud of. He'd be like, good job, Morgan.
Won.
Good job, Morg. A little spiciness from MZ. James Madison loves it. We have the bust of James Madison. Appropriate today because we're back into a paper written by him. You guys are going to like this. This is one of my favorite papers.
It's a good one.
It was a solid one. It's introductory because, like I said, this is the first one in the second last section of the Federalist. I have a lot of quotes, Connor. Rapid fire today.
Rapid fire.
Rapid fire. Here we go. The title of the paper by James Madison, a.k.a. Publius. Number 37, concerning the difficulties of the convention in devising a proper form of government. He starts off. As the ultimate object of these papers is to determine clearly and fully the merits of this Constitution and the expediency of adopting it, our plan cannot be completed without taking a more critical and thorough survey of the work of the Convention, without examining it on all sides, comparing it in all parts, and calculating its probable effects. That this remaining task may be executed under impressions conducive to a just and fair result, some reflections must in this place be indulged, which candor previously suggested. So he's like, listen, we've got to go through all aspects of this proposal because you deserve it. We all need to do it in order to have the best decision, the best outcome. And we're about to get into it. That's what he's saying.
Pretty much.
All right. Next section, rapid fire. He says, it is a misfortune inseparable from human affairs that public measures are rarely investigated with that spirit of moderation, which is essential to a just estimate of their real tendency to advance or obstruct the public good. What I really like about this, Connor, is he takes a very philosophical approach to this throughout the paper. And one of those main points that he's making is that people cannot just look at objective truth
right.
and basic fact and make a decision. We often bring emotion and passion and human affairs into the mix, and it makes things messy.
Of course it does. You also bring nature into it. And he goes in to talk about how history can be a guide into determining what will happen next. You can't just leave that out of the equation, expect to have a fruitful kind of discussion about what's going to come if you don't look at what came before you, right?
Yeah.
We're standing on the shoulders of great, large people. And Madison kind of aptly lays that out here really beautifully. It's a really well-written paper. If you like just rhetoric and persuasive text and all of that. It's actually really, it's well written.
It was beautiful. It was. I was reading it and I just was smiling as I was doing it because some papers are kind of hard. This one was just really enjoyable. Next section, Connor, I found this hilarious. he says, in some, it has been too evident from their own publications that they have scanned the proposed constitution, not only with a predisposition to censor, but with a predetermination to condemn. Mm-hmm. And then later on, so he's basically saying some people only scanned it. They didn't give it a proper look through. They didn't give it a proper evaluation. They scanned the proposed document of the Constitution. And he says, but the truth is that these papers are not addressed to those kind of people, to the persons falling under these characteristics. He says, they solicit the attention of those only who add to a sincere zeal for the happiness of their country, a temper favorable to a just estimate of the means of promoting it. Persons of this character will proceed to an examination of the plan submitted by the convention, not only without a disposition to find or to magnify faults, but will see the propriety of reflecting that a faultless plan was not to be expected. No. So first of all, he's saying, listen, there's people out there that won't even give this a fair shake to begin with, and I'm not interested in even trying to change their mind. That's how I feel about communists. I'm not interested in trying to win them over. I'm not going to waste my time. I'm going to talk to people that genuinely have concerns, that want to find solutions. Whether we fully agree or not, we at least have a good heart and good intentions for the future of the country. That's what he's saying here. What he also starts to get into a little bit down is that, listen, the guys that wrote this were not perfect.
No.
This document is not perfect, but that's to be expected. It was never intended to be a perfect document, but hey, we really did our best here. And that's what we hope that people who understand this will see and will support.
Yeah, if you go back to the preamble of the Constitution, it doesn't open up with some utopian ideal that says we're going to create a perfect society. No, it says we, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. It's not about being perfect. It's about striving for that which is good and more perfect, right? Because the only thing perfect in our universe, in our realm, is heaven, right?
Oh.
That's utopia. That's where utopia lies. It doesn't lie on earth, right? You're only going to find that if you know your Savior and you're going to end up there one day, right? The founders knew a fundamental truth. They know that God exists and they know that they were not God and they cannot create heaven on earth. And that's what the communists always try to do. They try to create utopia, right? And they fail every single time. So our founders were knowledgeable of that, not the communists specifically, but they were knowledgeable that the idea of utopia is unattainable. Because they read Augustine, they read Aquinas, and they read those great thinkers who were so informed by the biblical roots of that which we go on to build our nation. So,
Connor, that was beautiful. That was really beautiful.
Thank you.
Way to bring that in. I think he gets into that too a little bit down the road. I highlighted it somewhere. You guys, so the next section as we get into this paper, he starts to go through the issues that the people experienced when writing this. And the first one is the fact that, listen, it's never been done before. This kind of government has never been attempted. And while we've talked about this a lot and the Federalist Papers are really about this, the founders went through history and said, okay, so we have these failed democracies and republics and confederacies or these current ones that are struggling. What did they do that was good? What did they do that was bad? Why did they fail? Why are they struggling now? And what can we do based on this learning to avoid those situations? It was basically a bunch of lessons, what Publius says, of what to not do.
It was like market research.
Yeah. There was nothing that said, here's the solution in the sense of this is what the alternative option should be that we go with in America. And so that was the first problem that they faced is you at least understand where to not go, but how do you then make the proper fix to all of those problems? And how do you actually structure a government to avoid those things?
Yeah. And he talks about all the ones that we've talked about before, Germany, the Netherlands, Rome, Greece, et cetera. So it just shows that they were informed by things that came before them, something that we seem to be ignoring in these days. We don't look to our founders anymore. We look to our own current wants, needs, and desires and try and pass them off as some sort of, you know, foundational basis for a republic, but they're really not. They're more just selfish, you know, blastings from arrogant men and women.
Right. And so this one, you guys, this is so important, especially today with current events that are going on in our country. The next problem he discusses is achieving a balance, mm-hmm. the proper balance for our country. He says, among the difficulties encountered by the convention, a very important one must have lain in combining the requisite stability and energy in government with the inviolable attention due to liberty and to the republican form. And so how do you balance basically safety and security?
Yeah. And the thing that he comes up with, and I was going to read this where we got there, unless I don't want to get ahead of you, but
no, go ahead.
He says, stability in government is essential to a national character and to the advantages annexed to it, as well as to that repose and confidence in the minds of the people, which are among the chief blessings of civil society, right? So if you have the confidence and the peace of the people who live in your society, then you're going to have a functioning republic, right? But in order to have that, you have to have stability. You can't just have these whiplash effects that you saw in Rome, right? Going from someone like Caligula to someone like
Caesar.
Yeah. So yeah, Caligula to Caesar or Caligula to Brutus or like Caligula to Mark, anything like that, right? Because what we saw was like this whiplash effect that went from republic to monarchy, to oligarchy, to triumvirate, to brutality, to peace, to prosperity, to poverty, right? And that is what creates the basis for the fall of Rome, is that you just don't have stability and you don't have the confidence of the people anymore. It was not vested in the form of government. It was vested in the heads of government. And stability, he goes on to say, stability, on the contrary, requires that the hands in which powers lodge should continue for a length of time the same. A frequent change of men will result from a frequent return of elections and a frequent change of measures from a frequent change of men, whilst energy in government requires not only a certain duration of power, but the execution of it by a single hand. The single hand, I think, that he's talking about here is not necessarily a direct, representation here. It's a matter of just like having a constitution as a guide. So mm-hmm. the constitution was something that was set up to last through the ages. We say it all the time. Charlie says it. The constitution was not written for the times. It was written to stand the test of times, right? And that is the point that we're starting to ignore now, bring it to current events a little bit. Nancy Pelosi, Speaker Pelosi, just put out a statement calling the Supreme Court, a 233-year-old institution, an extremist group. Did you see this? Extremist group, as if they were like Antifa or MS-13. The Supreme Court of the United States is now an extremist group. I can't think of anything that would undermine the stability of law and order and the rule of law in a civil society more than calling the bedrock of order and the bedrock of law and stability something that is like, if you look at the black robes, why do we wear black robes? Because it cloaks any form of subjectivity. You're all the same. It's all objective. Why is Lady Liberty blinded whenever she's carrying the weights of justice? Because it's all objective. It removes subjectivity. You can't just go around calling something that is the bedrock of civil society some extremist group, because they're not. They're deliberative and they're judicious, right? But the left is so focused on undermining all of our institutions to create a utopia, which they say in the papers, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be perfect. It's going to be more perfect. That they're willing to set aside institutions and precedent in the name of political power. And that is how you create instability.
Yeah.
And it's almost like they want the instability, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, intentional or incompetence? The answer is intentional.
Maybe both.
It's like Maxine Waters saying, to hell with the Supreme Court.
Well, yeah.
Or AOC saying, illegitimate. Did you see her?
Illegitimate.
Thread?
Yeah.
Her entire thread, she did a breakdown of why basically none of the conservative justices on the Supreme Court
were legally put
on there. That's quite a claim to make.
Well, it's something that an insurrectionist would say, isn't it? Because they're trying to undermine the form of government that we've established here. So they're trying to undermine it. And we're seeing that they're going to try and do that violently. We just saw a Supreme Court justice face an assassination attempt, right? On his house, Brett Kavanaugh, his family. So these people are so hell-bent on, it's not just about abortion, right? This issue is coming up and it's bubbling up to the surface because of Roe versus Wade, mm-hmm. but it's actually happening because this is just the perfect springboard, they think, for them to achieve their more, overarching political goals, which is, like I said earlier, to fundamentally destabilize and crumble the republic which our founders built and which good Americans over the ages have built.
Yeah.
On the foundation of the Constitution.
Well, I find it so interesting. I mean, this has really sparked a whole new conversation about what the future of the conservative movement looks like. And I'm seeing a lot of people. I mean, you saw Dave Portnoy. He immediately freaked out. People said, good job, you guys. You just lost all the momentum. And I'm like,
no.
This is what is going to help us lose all the momentum when our country is entering a depression, basically, because of Joe Biden. You're saying that this is going to lead to us losing all of the momentum on our side. It's just so strange how a lot of these people think, and people are talking about, is this the rise of barstool conservatism or is it the decline of it? And are we reverting back to the 90s control your morality, control your lifestyle vibe that the conservative movement had? And I'm just looking at all of it. And to me, especially after reading Age of Entitlement, I'm just like, thank goodness we have Connor Clegg's out there in a world of Dave Portnoy's, you know what I mean?
Thank you.
You're welcome. I kept thinking that about you of, oh my gosh, I cannot believe that they have succeeded so far that us advocating for something as simple as this, something that's not in the Constitution, just the Supreme Court saying this is not in the Constitution is enough to what? Encourage the left to dismantle our most fundamental aspects of our government and then us to get criticized so much. So to say that all of the economic failures caused by the administration right now are worth it just because conservatives have become too radical with Roe v. Wade. None of it makes sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, look, here's the thing is that the court made a very moderate ruling here. They didn't make some sort of a radical ruling that said abortion is now outlawed in the United States of America. They simply sent it back to the states. Now, if it were up to me, if I were on the court, I would make a much more radical ruling that says that we can't continue to justify the killing of unborn children based on this notion of a false constitutional right. That's wrong and it's outlawed carte blanche, right? No, we simply sent it back to the states and trusted the federal system. The federal system seems to be working out because right now we have 15 states and counting that are now banning abortion, right? This isn't a show about abortion. It's a show about federalism and the Federalist Papers. But what it is about in this regard is this notion of stability. The court took that into account. And despite what I think Clarence Thomas and Alito and maybe Kavanaugh, maybe Barrett, maybe Gorsuch wanted to do, which I think was probably more on the line of a more radical ruling, they had temperance and they brought themselves back and they reined themselves and they created a moderate ruling. Now, the left doesn't like moderate things, right? Mm-hmm. They trash the moderate as extreme if it benefits their political philosophy. And now we're seeing the upheaval of an institution based on this idea. And we can't let them do it is what it comes down to. And the conservative movement needs to go back to moral order and stability because those are the things that ground society, that ground civil society. Good morals, good people, good ethics create a country that's worth living in that people want to live in.
Yeah, well, and this is where I didn't understand why can't they connect two and two? I'm hearing people say—
Because they don't want to.
Well, what we should be focusing on is economic independence and then social liberal values. Mm-hmm. And in that sense that I've heard people literally in one sentence say, we need to continue this barstool conservative kind of vibe where we don't dictate people's morality. We don't encourage social issues. We don't even care about social issues really, but we just draw the line at least with sexualizing kids in the classroom and stopping the craziness. And in my head, I'm like, how do you not see that because we stopped caring about those things, it led to now you have naked people in the street dancing in front of children that are probably pedophiles.
Obviously a slippery slope.
And we have gotten really off track.
Well, we haven't, frankly. It's about stability.
Instability. And Connor, speaking of that, first of all, before we move on to the next issue, what I still loved so much about this stability concept, stability versus energy, stability in government is essential to national character. Mm-hmm. Imagine if we still had one of those. But we're going to fix that. Connor and I and many other young conservatives are going to make families, make a bunch of babies, and then out-procreate the left. Is that the proper term?
I mean, we're not going to
And we're going to create a national character.
Right. And a national character is something that we have to get back to, right? Because we talk all the time about exporting American ideals and exporting American values when it comes to foreign policy. We no longer have American ideals or American values, right? What are we going to do? Export drag queens on every corner in Ukraine? No, I don't want to do that, right? I don't feel proud to say that America is exceptional anymore because the current state of the nation that we live in, we've just completely ignored the things that have made us exceptional. And yes, those are socially, moral, biblical values, right? If we just stop acting like we were founded on this Judeo-Christian roots, then we are just going to become another nation, unexceptional and unimpressive.
Yep.
Another good book everyone should read is The Roots of American Order by Russell Kirk. It talks about what actually underlies and undergirds and built the foundation for this social conservatism, right? Which is actually the way that the founders intended our country to be.
Well, that'd be nice. Speaking of social issues and Roe v. Wade, I wanted to bring up Roe v. Wade anyways, because the next issue Publius talks about is not less arduous must have been the task of marking the proper line of partition between the authority of the general mm-hmm. and that of the state governments. And so imagine, like, put yourself in the shoes of you're a bunch of sweaty, hot men in this convention hall trying to write a new form of government. You have to deal with things as simple yet complicated as, wait, this has never been done before, so right. we don't exactly have an example. The next thing is, how do you balance people's security versus safety and the energy versus stability of the government? But then this is the next big thing. If this is a federalist system, then what do we actually say the states can do versus what can the federal government do? And that's where we get into the concept of federalism, like mm-hmm. you said with Roe v. Wade. The court did not ban abortion. The court said this is a state issue. Mm-hmm. You don't have a constitutional right. What Roe argued was that you have a right to privacy
right.
in the due process clause of the Bill of Rights, and right. that gives you the right to make the private decision of getting an abortion.
Right.
The justices came back with this overturning and said, you're ending a human life. That's not something that should be a private decision. It doesn't say that that's a private decision in the Constitution.
No.
And so this is being removed. The states will go back to handling it. I would argue, though, I'm like you, Connor. I'm quite radical in this, and I don't think this is radical at all to say, but one of the most important concepts of our government is to protect the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness,
uh-huh.
the right to life. That's totally. All I'll say about that. So one of the big issues is, how do you determine the powers for the states?
Yeah, I mean, so the federal government has to exist to create guardrails, right? And how wide or how narrow those guardrails are is what is to be determined by federal and national elections,
mm-hmm.
right? So the party that becomes in control of the federal government kind of gets to dictate where those guardrails stand. Now, the states get to act within those guardrails. That's how that works. So a state can be more loose on abortion. They can be more restrictive on it. But it has to happen within the premise that is set at the federal level that says, hey, or it should say, hey, killing an innocent person is wrong. We have murder laws in this nation. Every law points towards a moral justice somehow. There's a reason why we have seatbelt laws. There's a reason why you slow down in school zones, right?
Mm.
Because we believe in the value of protecting innocent life. The issue of abortion has been so perverted and so convoluted by bad actors, I think, to say that it's about a woman's right to choose, when in reality we're losing the plot. We jumped the shark. We think that it's about the right to kill somebody,
yeah.
which even in California right now, right? If you murder a pregnant woman, and I say woman intentionally because it's not a birthing person, it's a
Thank
woman.
You, Connor.
If you murder a pregnant woman, you are charged with double homicide. In 2022, in California, one of the most radical abortion states in the union, they still recognize the fact that a life within the womb is a life and it's worth protecting. So why that doesn't extend across the board to this idea of abortion is beyond me. It's because they have a willful neglect of the laws, because the federal government has decided not to set a firm guardrail on either side and say that life must be protected.
Yeah.
We make it too loose. We leave it up to too much interpretation to the states. And that's where the federalist system failed, because if you don't have a small but strong federal government to set the guidelines for these states, then the states are going to run rampant. They're going to go crazy into this idea of laboratories of democracy or whatever. And it's like,
yeah.
that's fine as long as you're acting with an established system.
Yeah, this seems kind of fundamental, the right to life. And that's where I get so confused by it. I also hear they call themselves conservatives. Uh-huh. People on the right is uh-huh. what I'm going to say. They look at actual conservatives that are against abortion and they say, well, that's not very small government of you.
No, it's not.
That's
You're
very
right.
big government. And to me, I'm like, actually, it kind of is. I want a strong but small government
right?
that protects the basic aspects of humanity
it's
in
really
our society.
Yeah.
The right to life. They are protecting someone from being killed, their heartbeat ending, their life ending.
Abortion stops a beating heart.
That is pretty simple to me. It's government doing a very basic job. It's supposed to stop people from being hurt. Either way, moving on, Connor, some pretty quotes.
Very
I had to
pretty,
highlight them.
Yes.
One of them, experience has instructed us that no skill in the science of government has yet been able to discriminate and define with sufficient certainty its three great provinces, the legislative, executive, and judiciary, or even the privileges and powers of the different legislative branches. That's such a simple but complicated statement,
mm-hmm.
because if you think about it, they're right. At that time especially, and still now to this day, nobody has been able to come up with the perfect balance of these things. And America, I would say, is the closest. But he goes on to say, and this is super pretty, the experience of ages with the continued and combined labors of the most enlightened legislators and jurists has equally has been equally unsuccessful in delineating the several objects and limits of different codes of laws and different tribunals of justice, the precise extent of the common law and the statute law and the maritime law and the ecclesiastical law and the law of corporations and the local laws and customs remains still to be clearly and finally established in Great Britain, where accuracy in such subjects has been more industriously pursued than in any other part of the world. Mm-hmm. And I think that was really special because it connected what was going on in another country with right. history. And if you think about it, there's a lot of laws that need to be made.
Yeah.
First of all, this is a great example of why the federal government should not be the only thing handling right. laws, because it cannot possibly handle it. It can barely right. handle what it's responsible with now. But that's why we have so many levels of government. And it's such a beautiful statement on we've had so many political thinkers and leaders of all kinds, whether they were elected or non-elected, that have tried to create structures. And it just hasn't worked before because humans are imperfect, I would say.
Right. He goes on to say, besides the obscurity arising from the complexity of objects and the imperfection of the human faculties, the medium through which the conceptions of men are conveyed to each other adds a fresh embarrassment. The use of words is to express ideas. Mm. It's a profound statement, but it's also it's very basic and simple, speaking to this idea of nature. And things just simply don't always change. It doesn't really matter how you say it or what comes into effect from what you say. It's just we have to put these ideas down on paper, and we have to create a groundwork and establish a constitution if we want to even get this ball rolling, right? And you can't be afraid of that which may not work at the risk of losing that which could be exceptional.
Oh,
and he lays it out really beautifully, that. I think.
No, I love that a lot. And so we're kind of at the end of the paper now. Connor, what I thought was really interesting is towards the end, he talks about how even if some perfect or near perfect political thinker was putting all of his energy and effort alone in his closet uh-huh. to come up with the perfect concept of a representative government rooted in federalism, it probably wouldn't have even looked like this.
No.
If anything, it would look like this. But the miracle here is that that's not what was happening here. It was a bunch of men, personalities with different passions, different views of the world, different views of government that in general agreed. And it wasn't like there was two parties arguing, but it was a group of men that had just fought the Revolutionary War. Mm-hmm. They're trying to build this government together on the same foundation. And even though they had all these differences, they still came together mm-hmm. in a public hall and created this. That's the point he's starting to make towards the end. And I think that's really special.
It's special. And it goes to show that, you know, you can have the best idea. The best laid plans of mice and men often go awry.
Yeah.
But it's about the execution of it. You can build a perfect rocket, but if you don't have the cooperation of so many different things to make it take off in space, then it doesn't really do you any good. And it's just a big hunk of metal that costs a lot of money.
Yeah. And what's so pretty, speaking of the God reference, I think you and I discussed it earlier in the episode. He says, it is impossible for the man of pious reflection not to perceive in it a finger of that almighty hand, which has been so frequently and signally extended to our relief in the critical stages of the revolution.
And damn it, sorry, were you going to say something?
No, that's it.
That phrase should be plastered everywhere, frankly, because I'm so sick and tired of having to refute this idea that the founders were not Christian people, right? That the founders did not believe in God, and that they weren't divinely inspired to write this, and they weren't passionately involved in the church and the church communities. If you look at it, aside from two, and I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, I've sent them to Charlie a million times because he makes this point all the time. But all of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and came together to ratify it, all but two of them were Christians, right? They were Catholics, they were Protestants, they were evangelicals of some sort, Episcopalians, George Washington was, even deists, right, like Thomas Jefferson. But they believed that there was a creator, and they believed that there was a God, and they believed that what they were doing was ordained by God. And so if you don't think that our founders were Christian, that they wanted to establish a nation that was inspired by divine right, then you're an idiot. And you're just refusing to read history because you're refusing to read that line that Morgan just read. My pen just rolled away. You're refusing to read that line that Morgan just read that says, it's impossible for the man of pious reflection not to perceive in it a finger of that almighty hand, which has been so frequently and signally extended to our relief in the critical stage of the revolution. God made this country, and we're letting people who don't believe in God and who hate God, in fact, destroy the country. They have no right to do that. They hate our founders. They hate God. They hate America. And we have to stop them. We have to defeat them. And that starts with bringing back moral order, creating a society of people who want to live in a country that is worth them living in, right? Lincoln said, I should like to see a nation ran by men who are worthy to run that nation. I'm paraphrasing a little bit. But I would also like to see a nation live in a way that is worthy of them living in that nation, right? And if we don't get back to this idea that this is a special place, it's an exceptional place, then we're going to lose it. That's what happened. That's what liberalism does. That's what the erosion of the Constitution does. It makes us just like everybody else. And we're not just like everybody else. We're better than everyone else. We can be. We were before. We got to get back to it. And that means that we have to have stability. We have to have order. And yes, we have to have moral righteousness in our laws and in our lawmaking. Wow. And that means God.
Connor Clegg. Well, let's end it there. You guys, I'm not going to butcher the last paragraph of this beautiful paper. I just highly encourage you to go read the last section of Federalist 37 because it's just beautiful. Connor, way to end this in a strong way. Thank you for that beautiful statement. I'm excited to be
on this new section of the Federalist Papers.
Me too. I'm really pumped. Good. I'm also excited to get educated. I don't know. I feel like I'm pretty aware of these things, but I'm also excited to get back to the basics.
Amen.
And see how wrong everything went.
And get out of the roots and the weeds of taxation and get back into something that's like much bigger and much more long-lasting and permanent and beautiful.
I'm excited, especially as they're talking literally as we speak about tearing it all down. You guys, thanks for watching Freedom Papers. We really appreciate it. Connor, thanks for joining.
Yeah, tune in next time.
Tune in next time.